will give people an inside view of Alaska's state-federal relationships for the last 40 years.
Senator Stevens' archives head to the University of Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 26th of February. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a new public awareness campaign on avoiding bear problems in Anchorage.
We want to engage people to think about it. We don't want people to be overly afraid.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
The federal government is expanding its investigation of price-fixing schemes as a former executive with the shipping company heads to federal prison on an antitrust conspiracy charge. The investigation has strengthened a damages lawsuit filed in Alaska. APRN's Dave Donaldson has more.
Peter Bocci worked for the same holding company that owns Totem Ocean Trailer Express, or TOTE, which carries 41% of the ocean freight headed to Alaska. Bocci and three other executives were convicted of fixing shipping prices in the eastern United States. The federal investigation is now on the West Coast. The class action lawsuit by Ace Delivery and Moving Company charges TOTE and Horizon Lines with taking part in a conspiracy, using as evidence various companies' practice of raising prices by identical amounts at or near the same time. And court documents say the plaintiff class includes, quote, hundreds or thousands of members, adding that the effects of the claim are so widespread that there would be too many to include. Ace Delivery charges that in 2004, the shipping companies began to engage in anti-competitive conduct to restrict space and fix prices, as much as rigging competitive bids and allocating customers. In the federal antitrust case, five executives pled guilty last fall to price fixing and customer allocation on shipments to Puerto Rico from the East Coast. Two of them had ties to Alaska trade. Horizon said in a press release at the time that the responsibilities of one of them included market intelligence and company pricing policy. The complaint says Alaskans have had to pay more for shipping goods than they would in a competitive marketplace, and they want to reclaim those overcharges and have the companies be subject to triple damages. In October, Horizon noted that litigation could have an adverse effect on the company's financial condition and results of operations, since it had not made any provision relating to the outcome of any litigation. Neither plaintiffs nor defendants' attorneys returned calls for more information on the suit. The case is scheduled in Anchorage's Federal District Court March 10th. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Governor Palin today gave her public support to two bills in the legislature that would require parental consent before an underage girl could have an abortion. She said she did not want to introduce a competing version of the House and Senate bills that were put into the mix early in the session. At a press conference with legislative supporters of the measures, Palin said the current policy drives a wedge between parents and children.
Wherever you fall on the abortion issue, right or left, this legislation is about families, and it's about parents' rights and protecting our children, and it's why it's supported by legislators on both sides of the aisle.
House Rules Chair John Coghill says the bills try to balance the protection of an individual's right while protecting parental rights.
Now, the way the court stands, it puts an absolute barrier between the parent and the child and does not allow the parent any right to have information. The problem with that is it gives Planned Parenthood or nurses or people who might have less of an interest in that child a greater access, and absolutely bars the child from the parent if the child so chooses.
The House Judiciary Committee now plans to hear the bill March 8th. Archives spanning Senator Ted Stevens' 40-year congressional career are on their way to the University of Alaska Fairbanks. The material is being shipped in nearly 5,000 boxes and weighs in at around 60 tons. It will be housed at the university's Rasmussen Library. Paul McCarthy is the retired Rasmussen Library Director and is advising the university on the Stevens collection. He says the amount of material makes sense, given the senator's long and powerful career.
expect, you know, the amount of accumulation increases as he got more responsibilities and the issues got more complex and they added more staff. So, you know, the earlier senators would have had, you know, a much smaller part of that. But he was in for 40 years and had, you know, an incredible number of prestigious committee assignments and leadership assignments. So he would have accumulated a vast historical record, not only that relates to Alaska, but national politics, too.
And what about the job to archive all of this material? How large will that be?
It's a pretty significant effort because it is the largest collection that the archives here has received. But the advantage with this is that Stevens had a sense of history from his initial time in office. And I've had contact with him through the years, and he's almost always had a professional archivist on staff working at least part-time to make sure that the files were in good order and archived well and stored well. So the task will be inventorying it, laying it back out in terms of the order that it's supposed to be in, and then reboxing it and putting it on shelves and making sure we know what is in which box.
And when you consider the immense collection of documents, what do you imagine these archives will be used for?
They will be used for, you know, seeing what the senator did and what the many issues were that were both public and maybe not so well known to the public between the senator, Alaska, and federal agencies involved. So it'll give you an idea of how the state, how the senators, and how the federal agencies work together or worked at, you know, cross purposes. It'll give you a sense of the effectiveness of Ted Stevens in terms of his legislative record, his budget record, and, you know, the things that were important for Alaska.
What type of restrictions are there on access to the archives?
Right now, it's a deposit with the university, so the senator retains legal title. We can work on the materials and develop the finding aids and process, but the records are restricted until 5 years after the senator's death.
And Mr. McCarthy, how important is it for this material to be housed at the university and in Alaska?
It's really critical. Stevens served longer than any other public figure in Alaska. And he had an immense impact both on federal and state relations. It will give people an inside view of Alaska's state-federal relationships for the last 40 years that would be impossible in any other way. I mean, he had leadership positions that placed him in an important position to advance Alaska's interests. So it's really an irreplaceable historical record.
Paul McCarthy is advising the University of Alaska on housing Senator Stevens' archives. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new Alaska Hall of Famer shares her philosophy on sports and life.
If you're going to do something, do it 100%. There's no point in being there if you're just going through the motions, but to really put your heart and soul into something.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alaska State Elks Lodges, providing children the opportunity to attend summer camp and other age-appropriate activities. Information at alaskastateelks.org.
The Senate Veterans Affairs Committee heard testimony today on the difficulties of caring for veterans in rural parts of the country. Alaska Democrat Mark Begich sits on the committee and said it's especially challenging in Alaska, which does not have a full-fledged Veterans Affairs or VA hospital. Begich asked witnesses testifying for the VA why veterans can't visit other hospitals and get reimbursed for medical expenses.
Why not just allow the veterans to utilize the services of any hub medical facility that, in this case, Native Hospital, which is run by a consortium of Native tribes, but also is funded by a federal agency anyway. I mean, it's all federal money. So Why not figure out a way that that system can be utilized much more aggressively than just a couple pilots, but just use them and then VA reimburse?
Begich says it's senseless for a veteran living in a village like Kwikluk to spend $1,500 on a plane ticket to get treatment. It's a concern Alaska's congressional delegation has voiced for years. The director of the Office of Rural Health at the VA, Kara Hawthorne, says there are some pilot programs underway that could correct the problem.
We also recognize that leveraging our community partners and the infrastructure already in rural areas is a direction that we do need to consider.
The Office of Rural Health, which Hawthorne directs, was just established in 2006. Last summer, the VA created a Rural Veterans Advisory Panel to work on how to improve care. Hawthorne says the Office of Rural Health has started a call-out program to veterans to ask how they're being treated and what they need, and is working on programs like training a traveling nurse corps and trying to better use technology. Witnesses who work for groups that advocate for veterans' rights testify that the current mental health treatment options for rural vets are woefully inadequate, and that without treatment, PTSD can lead to depression and suicide. Alaska has more than 70,000 veterans. About 25% of them live off the road system. A two-day climate change conference sponsored by the Alaska Marine Conservation Council is taking place in Homer. Attendees from coastal communities across the state are hoping to finalize a compact that would outline their concerns about global warming, ocean acidification, and other issues, and then request state and federal action to fix the problems. KBBI's Casey Kelly has more.
The conference includes participants from Dillingham, Kodiak, Gustavus, Petersburg, and Sitka, as well as Homer. Most of the first day was set aside for presentations by experts from the government, science, and environmental fields. Deborah Williams, Executive Director of Alaska Conservation Solutions, started her presentation by talking about how to handle climate change skeptics. She says she usually gives them the sleeping bag analogy.
Just like we all know that we are much warmer in a thick, well-insulated down sleeping bag than we are in a very thin, poorly insulated down sleeping bag. Scientists tell us that we are much warmer on the Earth when our atmosphere is super insulated with greenhouse gases such as carbon dioxide than when it is not.
Williams says the scientific evidence that global warming is occurring is irrefutable. So are its effects on coastal communities in Alaska.
Whether it's from sea level rise, whether it's from massive, unprecedented erosion, whether it's because their economies depend on fishing, which are so vulnerable to the impacts of global warming, both temperature increases as well as ocean acidification. People on the coast of Alaska are some of the most important spokespeople.
And she says that's why the compact that conference attendees will hopefully draft here is so vitally important.
All of the evidence points to the fact that Alaska is vulnerable, that if we don't address global warming, it will be prohibitively expensive.
Suzanne Fleek, state director for Senator Mark Begich, also gave a presentation. She focused on the federal government's ability and willingness to tackle climate change issues. Fleek says members of President Barack Obama's science team plan to make issues like global warming and ocean acidification a top priority.
People that have a deep background in both the science as well as the policy and the diplomacy on climate change. So they're ready to go, as well as, you know, an incoming Congress that still has, I think, a very strong appetite to act on this. As well as the fact I was here to highlight that the Economic Recovery Bill has a number of pots of money that Alaskans can access to take steps right now to address climate change.
Fleek also says her boss, Senator Begich, is hoping to use his position on various committees to deal with the concerns of those at the conference.
He does believe that we need to get moving on global warming legislation. So these coastal communities have a very strong voice. They're seeing the impacts. They also are taking steps right now to cut global warming emissions and to save energy and to save money for their communities.
Participants hope to have the language of their compact finalized and ready to bring back to their respective communities by the time they wrap up. In Homer, I'm Casey Kelly.
Outdoor enthusiasts in Anchorage will soon be the target of a new information campaign on bear safety. After a string of severe bear attacks last year on popular trails near the city, wildlife managers are hoping the right message will help ensure a more peaceful summer in 2009. APRN's Annie Fite reports.
When Wade Willis heads out on one of the trails near Anchorage, it's not always exactly a serene experience for the people and wildlife around him.
Yeah, I hoot really loud.
Willis, who heads up the Anchorage Office of Defenders of Wildlife, describes himself as an outdoor enthusiast. He loves the fact that a mix of brown and black bears share the city with Anchorage residents. Willis says making lots of noise is a basic in bear country that many people know, but not everyone puts to use.
I think folks are shy in general. You know, going out into the wilderness is a peaceful, quiet, a settling experience, and to go out there and rattle the trees with your hoots is kind of anti what you're going there for. So I think it's hard for folks to step over and to make noise.
Convincing people to make more noise and travel with a friend or two are two of the main goals of the recently formed Anchorage Bear Education Committee. A long and diverse list of agencies and organizations are participating in the group's monthly gatherings, including the City of Anchorage, Defenders of Wildlife, and the Anchorage School District. Elizabeth Manning with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game is organizing it all. She's been reading through responses to a survey the department sent out asking for advice from the public.
I had quite a few people say things like, there's a lot of information out there, but to be honest, I'm not quite sure what to do if I actually encounter a bear, or I don't really know how to tell the difference between a black bear and a brown bear, and can that information be more readily available?
Over the years, wildlife managers have concentrated a lot on the message of keeping trash away from bears. Manning says after the attacks last summer, the department realized it needed to focus on educating recreational trail users.
We want to engage people to think about it. We don't want people to be overly afraid that they don't want to go out and recreate. I mean, that's partially what happened last summer, as we saw a lot of areas that became like ghost towns, and we don't want to have that happen again. So we want people to know the risks, but also, you know, still get outside and still recreate, which is a good thing to do.
The group is working on an ad campaign that will ask Anchorage residents if they're bear aware. They'll also distribute weatherproof cards with basic advice on steering clear of bears. And they're holding a short film contest with a bear safety theme to tap the creativity of the public. John McClary is with the city's Parks and Recreation Department. He says getting the right message to the right people can make a difference.
Anything we can do to improve people's bear awareness, to give them the secrets and the hints of what to do, especially those people that recreate alone, such as bikers, runners, hikers, dog walkers in our parks, if they can know one thing that, say, gives them a better risk prevention tool, we've met our goal.
But even the most knowledgeable trail users can still get into trouble occasionally. Many members of the bear education group are outdoor enthusiasts themselves, and Elizabeth Manning says they don't always avoid dangerous behavior.
Some members of this group have said, I like to run alone, and I'm still going to run alone, but the difference is I know the risks, and I acknowledge that I'm taking some risks when I run alone in bear country, and I'm taking a much higher risk if I'm running alone in bear country along a salmon stream.
And they also know that reducing that risk may be a simple matter of hooting loudly as often as possible along the way. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Fite.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Five Alaska athletes will be inducted into the Alaska Sports Hall of Fame tonight at ceremonies in Anchorage, including Juno Olympic skier Hillary Lind. KTOO's Rosemary Alexander has the story.
Hillary Lind was a little tyke when she learned to ski at Juno's Eagle Crest ski area. She soon took to racing, and it wasn't long before she was winning. At age 14, she joined the United States ski team and left Juno to attend Romark Ski Academy in Salt Lake City, Utah. 2 years later, Lind was the first American to win the downhill title in the World Junior Championships.
Well, she's had a very, very decorated alpine skiing career.
Chris Meyer is a board member of the Alaska Sports Hall of Fame. While medals and accomplishments are important, he says, an athlete's connection with Alaska is a major part of the selection criteria. Meyer says Lind was an overwhelming pick for the class of 2009, someone Alaskans can call one of their own.
We've had plenty of famous athletes that have come through here. Barry Bonds, Mark McGuire, you know, big sports stars. Kirk Schilling was actually born in Anchorage, but they're really not bringing a lot back to the state as far as an Alaskan. I think Hillary Lind is just the opposite. I mean, here is someone who did all this coming out of Alaska, and Alaska was the base and really represented Alaska well, and I think a lot of the citizens and residents of this great state, I think, really see that too.
In her 11-year skiing career, Lind had 27 top 10 finishes, 3 World Cup championships, and a silver medal at the 1992 Olympics at Albertville, France. She was the only American to win a medal at the 1997 World Championships in Italy. Lind recalls it had been a difficult season, and she even wondered if she should still be competing.
After struggling a lot through that season, it was just kind of the culmination of sticking with it and hard work and all of that stuff, so that was really the biggest reward, what I was most proud of.
Lind spent a lot of her youth as a ski racer and soon learned that struggles as well as successes define us in life.
Whether it's the traditional goal setting and focus and persistence and hard work and all that stuff, but I think some really valuable life lessons like working with people that you might not always choose to associate with, you know, learning how to ask for help when you need it, taking responsibility for yourself. You can't blame poor results on other people or on other situations. You really have to step up and take responsibility for what you've done in preparation or what you did in the race or whatever it is. So I think those kind of lessons that you learn along the way, whether they come from ski racing or another sport or some other facet of your life, make us who we are.
She says she found real joy in pushing herself, and that's her advice to young athletes.
If you're going to do something, do it 100%. There's no point in being there if you're just going through the motions, but to really put your heart and soul into something. And then even if you don't have the success that you want, you know you've done everything you can.
Hillary Lind retired from alpine ski racing in 1997. While completing her bachelor's degree at the University of Utah, she was a member of the Board of Trustees for the Salt Lake Olympic Committee. Then she did a master's degree at the University of British Columbia. Now she's married, has a daughter, and works as a biologist for an environmental consulting firm. At 3, her daughter is already on skis.
She's the wedge master.
Lind lives in Squamish, B.C., between Vancouver and Whistler, but hasn't forgotten her Alaska roots. She will share the Alaska Sports Hall of Fame podium tonight with Nordic skiing Olympian Nina Kempel and Alaska baseball pioneer Red Boucher. 2 posthumous awards go to Colonel Norman Vaughn, longtime polar explorer and adventurer, who died in 2005 at the age of 100. Also Alaska's first big-time basketball star, Wally Leisk, from Metlakatla. He died at the age of 84 in 2004. 2 moments in Alaska sports history will also be inducted at the Anchorage ceremony. The first winter ascent of Mount McKinley in 1967, and Doug Herron's national best in the 800 meters at the 1985 Alaska High School Track and Field Championships. The World Eskimo Indian Olympics will be inducted as the event. In Juneau, I'm Rosemarie Alexander.
A handful of racers are still out on the Yukon Quest Trail. 8 of the 29 mushers that started this year's Yukon Quest have scratched. Sometimes a single decision can dash a chance at victory, something Hugh Neff discovered this year. KUAC's Dan Bross reports on 2 other mushers who almost fell short due to decisions that yielded less than desired results.
This was William Cleedon's year. That's what everybody kept saying. The man who had finished second or third 4 times in 11 previous Yukon Quests was due. So when he took over the lead midway through this year's race, it appeared victory was finally in his destiny. The smooth running continued until 160 miles short of the finish line when the magic went out of his carpet. Cleedon's previously disciplined dogs suddenly turned their attention from racing to breeding. Cleedon says bringing a lead dog in heat undermined an otherwise great team.
I think there was no other team out there this year that could have beaten this team. So I had to beat myself, which I did. I did the wrong decision with including another leader, which was in heat when the race began. But it was the only leader that was experienced in the Quest Trail. That's why I did that. But I know I could have done it without, probably.
Cleedon, who was free-falling in the standings, says his troubles continued even after he dropped the leader in heat.
The dog team wasn't even thinking about running or racing or that. Nothing. There was nothing I could do. And actually the worst for me was going to Rosebud and over. I had to push that sled myself over it because the dogs were in a totally different world. And by the time I got over that hill, I had to camp out for 4 hours. Not because the dogs needed a break. I mean, they were not pulling anything anyways. They were thinking, they were mad now that I left this bitch at the truck. And that's literally, I mean, it's not a joke. They were totally disinterested in anything.
Cleedon says it wasn't until the final 45-mile stretch into Fairbanks Tuesday that his team began running up to potential again. Cleedon finished in sixth place, well short of the victory that seemed in his grasp just 2 days earlier. Right behind him was Brent Sass, another musher who gambled on a decision that ended up costing him several spots and several $1,000s in the standings. Sass tried to run all the way from the central checkpoint to the race's final stop at Two Rivers. The over 100-mile push was an attempt to gain on the three teams at the front of the race, but Sass says the bold plan backfired.
It was quite a journey, and it was great, but I think I pushed the dogs a little harder there, and that's when I paid for it.
Sass says warm weather and slow trail bogged down his dogs, and that the 8-hour mandatory rest at the last checkpoint wasn't enough to revive them. His team stalled out on the 45-mile run into Fairbanks. Speaking at the finish line, Sass said it took some extra rest and a special lead dog named Silver to cut his losses.
He just keeps coming back, you know, and he was the only one that, you know, you could tell he stood up and wanted to go, but there were seven other dogs that just kind of wanted to lay down. And eventually, we got him to go, and I don't think I could have done it without Silver. There's no doubt about that.
Sass crossed the line in seventh place after getting passed by two other teams he'd been ahead of since the beginning of the race. Sass is known for always finding the bright side and maintained a positive attitude after the race, despite obvious disappointment at falling short of his goal. Sass, whose outgoing personality endears him to race watchers, was applauded by exuberant friends and fans as he mushed his dogs from the finish chute to his truck for some much-deserved rest. Reporting on the Yukon Quest Trail in Fairbanks, I'm Dan Ross.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Casey Kelly in Homer, Rosemary Alexander in Juneau, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Prophet is our webmaster. Duncan Moon is our vice president for media production. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide insurance coverage for Alaskans who may feel they have become uninsurable. It offers hope to people with certain high-risk chronic illnesses or those who have exhausted employer-based insurance, and to some under 65-year-olds who are Medicare eligible. Find out more. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. More information at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.